ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's a court that believes in a strong executive in a whole lot of ways.
The Supreme Court once again hands more power to President Donald Trump. We'll examine the big cases at the end of this year's term and what they tell us about its balance of power. For Saturday, June 28th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Minnesota. A former State House speaker was laid to rest today. We'll hear the latest from the funeral, and we'll head to the Mexico-California border.
There is a change happening with people realizing that the dream can be lived in Tijuana with a lot less red tape.
We'll also talk to the director of a new documentary on astronaut Sally Ride. It tells the full story of her life, including parts Ride hid.
In her final weeks of life, she made the decision that Tam should tell this story and said, we should be who you think we should be to the public.
Plus 7 new albums from Bruce Springsteen. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In a rare Saturday session, a vote to begin debate on President Trump's sweeping tax and spending bill is underway as Republican senators try to find enough votes to pass the legislation. They already cut a series of deals with Republicans who are unhappy with the bill, but they can only afford to lose 3 votes. There's still no fiscal breakdown from congressional watchdogs either, so the full cost of the bill isn't known. Democrats are against it. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Many Republican senators have admitted they're not happy with this bill. One said it will take away health care from working people. And yet there's still a yes on this bill. If Republican senators are not happy with this bill because they know how badly it hurts their constituency, they should vote no.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune praised it.
We have before us today a once-in-a-generation opportunity to deliver legislation to create a safer, stronger, and more prosperous America.
The GOP is trying to pass it by Trump's self-imposed July 4th deadline. President Trump won a victory in the Supreme Court yesterday when the court held that a single district court ruling on his order to end birthright citizenship cannot be applied to the entire country. NPR's Anna Isaacs has more.
The justices did not rule on the merits of the order, which declares that children born in the U.S. to parents without legal status or on a temporary visa are not entitled to automatic citizenship. That order is still blocked for at least the next 30 days. After that, the order could go into effect in the states that have not challenged it. That means the rules for citizenship could differ state by state, which critics warn will lead to chaos and confusion. The Supreme Court has asked the lower courts to reconsider their broad rulings. In the meantime, there are also class action lawsuits in the works. The case's central question, whether denying birthright citizenship is constitutional, may come before the high court as soon as next term. Anna Isaacs, NPR News, Washington.
Hong Kong's last remaining political opposition party is dissolving itself right before the 5th anniversary of a sweeping national security law. NPR's Emily Fang reports the law has made most political dissent nearly impossible.
The League of Social Democrats is one of the largest opposition parties that took a more radical approach to demanding rights like direct elections for Hong Kong's chief executive and protests against rising wealth inequality. They'd won seats in Hong Kong's legislature in previous elections. And after the national security law was imposed in 2020, much of what the party did fell into the broad categories of activities considered subversive under the law. But unlike other parties, they did not immediately disband. However, this weekend they say they will dissolve after facing serious pressure from Beijing. The party's vice chair was just released from prison, and the party's chair remains imprisoned on charges related to their political work. Emily Fang, NPR News.
This is NPR News. More than 1,200 authors, including Jody Pico and Paul Tremblay, have signed a petition asking publishing houses to do more to protect them against the impacts of generative artificial intelligence. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports until now, writers have mostly fought back against AI through lawsuits targeting AI companies.
The petition circulated after a group of around 70 writers released an open letter on Friday morning. It asked publishers to refrain from publishing books created using AI tools built on copyrighted content without authors' consent or compensation, and to only hire human audiobook narrators, among other requests. The appeal to publishers comes after federal judges ruled in favour of tech companies Anthropic AI and Meta in two copyright infringement cases launched by authors. NPR reached out to all five of the major American publishing houses for comment. In a statement, Simon & Schuster spokesperson Susanna Lawrence said her company is taking the authors' concerns seriously. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Chrysler's parent company, Stellantis, says it's voluntarily recalling some of its 2022 to 2025 Pacifica and Voyager vehicles in order to inspect and possibly replace side airbags if needed. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says some of those airbags may not hold enough pressure during deployment to protect passengers in the event of a crash because of improperly sealed seams. Stellantis says it's not aware of any injuries or accidents. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Today in Minnesota, former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark were laid to rest. The bells at the Basilica of St. Mary could be heard across downtown Minneapolis. The Hortmans were killed in their homes 2 weeks ago by a man authorities say posed as a police officer. He's also accused of wounding a state senator and his wife and allegedly had planned to seek out other targets before he was apprehended. The act of political violence stunned the country, though today's funeral focused more on the lives lost. We're joined now by Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters, who was there. Hi, Clay.
Hello.
Set the scene for us of what you saw today.
It was the historic Basilica of St. Mary, just really a cornerstone of Catholic faith in Minneapolis since 1914. Former President Joe Biden and former Vice President Kamala Harris were there. They were seated in the front row next to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. The Hortmans' two adult children and Hortman's parents were there. There was a steady stream of state lawmakers of both major political parties walking into this just big, beautiful old church.
Clay, for several weeks we've been talking about the fact that these deaths come as the country has been worried about a rise in political violence, including those attempts on President Trump's life last year. How was that issue addressed at the funeral?
The eulogies were focused primarily on the Hortmans' lives, their public service, their good humor. I only covered Representative Hortman for a couple years, but can confirm that she was quick-witted and approachable. But those speaking from the front of the church did bring up political violence. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the most recent Democratic vice presidential candidate, of course, gave one of the eulogies. He says many are trying to understand what this moment represents.
Maybe it is this moment where each of us can examine the way we work together, the way we talk about each other, the way we fight for things we care about, a moment when each of us can recommit to engaging in politics and life the way Mark and Melissa did, fiercely, enthusiastically, heartily, but without ever losing sight of our common humanity.
And I do want to note, Scott, the man accused of killing the Hortmans and seriously wounding that other Democratic state lawmaker and his wife has been charged with murder.
I mean, Clay, this must have been especially tough in Minnesota.
Yeah, I mean, early in the Mass, Father Daniel Griffith brought up that Minnesota has been ground zero before for racial injustice in 2020 with the police killing of George Floyd, and he noted that was just a few miles from this church.
And now we are the ground zero place for political violence and extremism. Both of these must be decried in the strongest possible terms, as they are respectively a threat to human dignity and indeed our democracy.
So clearly this has been a shock to the Twin Cities community. Thousands paid their respects as the couple lay in state in the Minnesota Capitol Rotunda on Friday. She was a leader in Democratic initiatives like abortion rights and free school lunch, and many felt they benefited from her directly.
Clay, are there any other moments that stuck out to you?
Couple, many mourners have just told me the last couple weeks they have to show up to say this kind of political violence will not stand here. Following the service today, the caskets were brought out in a procession. It was solemn. A light drizzle fell as people gathered on the steps. Governor Walz presented the Hortman's children, Colin and Sophie, with an American flag. And as the hearses drove away, Scott, you could tell many will still be struggling with this for a long time.
That is Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters. Clay, thanks for covering this for us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
This week, at the end of its term, the Supreme Court handed down a spate of decisions that add up to big wins for the Trump administration. Lower courts' ability to block policies across the country has now been largely halted, something President Trump had been urging the high court to do all year. The term also gave Trump more power over independent agencies, among other wins. It is the second year in a row that a Supreme Court term has ended with expanded powers for the presidency. Here to unpack those decisions is Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr. Greg, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Let's start with this birthright citizenship case. This is complicated because it involves this core question of who is a U.S. citizen, but it was actually fundamentally about whether or not federal judges have the authority to issue nationwide injunctions. What did the court say about each of those issues?
Well, first of all, you're right that it wasn't about the legality of Donald Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. It was all about the power of federal judges and what they can do when they decide that something an administration or any other government entity is doing is illegal. And the Supreme Court said the thing that they've been doing a lot, which is issuing nationwide injunctions, maybe a single person or a single group sues and a judge blocks a policy nationwide, they can't do that anymore. That is beyond the power of the federal judiciary.
That has been such a key feature of our politics for more than a decade now. You go back to the Obama administration. A president tries to do something, somebody sues, it's held up. What does this ruling mean going forward for those challenges that we've become so accustomed to?
Unquestionably, it will make it more difficult. But the court did leave open some other avenues, and we'll have to see how broad those avenues are. One of them is that people can bring class actions, and you have to go through some more hoops. It's not automatic, but if you can file a lawsuit, and people may try to do that in birthright citizenship, actually they've already tried to do that in birthright citizenship, to say, hey, we're filing on behalf of everybody who's like us across the country, or maybe just in the state or something like that. Judge, can you give us an order blocking the policy as to that class? That's at least still a theoretical avenue for them.
But this topic is such an extreme example of the questions that this raises, right? Because this creates this patchwork approach of if you're part of the initial challenge, it applies to you. It doesn't apply to other people. I mean, what does that mean for people born in the United States to people who aren't here legally? Are you a citizen in one state or not a citizen in another state at the moment?
Not at the moment. It is a possible outcome of this.
Okay.
So this is a very complicated thing, and so that's part of the reason why you don't want to jump to too many conclusions. There's also this issue that some states have sued, and so I think that's what you were alluding to, that in the state of New Jersey, for example, it may be we end up in a world where if you're born in New Jersey, a baby is a citizen, but if born in a state that's not part of the suit, they're not a citizen. But we're not there yet, and these are issues that the lower courts are going to have to work out.
These injunctions against the Trump administration have been a major part of the news cycle this year. What happens to all of the ones that had already been issued across a wide range of things that Trump is trying to do?
Well, the president said that they are going to try to block a lot of these nationwide injunctions, citing the Supreme Court ruling. And those may well be successful in a lot of cases. And in each of those, the question will then be, how about those other avenues? Is there a way that somebody can bring a class action and get to the same place? And I don't think we know the answer to that. I think it's just going to take a while to work out.
I want to come back to these big questions about power. But first, I do want to talk about one other ruling at the end of the term. This came from a group of parents in Maryland suing to opt to get their children out of lessons that included books with LGBTQ characters. The court handed them a victory yesterday. What are the implications for parents and for schools from that ruling?
Well, it's certainly a significant decision. It's one that said that because parents have a right to control the religious upbringing of their children, that they constitutionally have to have a right to get notice and to opt out of lessons if it violates their religious beliefs. It's going to make it harder for schools to incorporate some things into the classroom for sure, because if parents have a right to opt out of things, anytime they do something that maybe bumps up against religious views, there's a risk that it will be much harder to present that lesson in class, and they'll have to, you know, jump through some big hoops. And the dissenters in that ruling yesterday certainly said that this is a huge problem for public education.
The conservative supermajority on the court is a huge storyline for several years now. What to you was most interesting, most surprising about how those six Republican-appointed judges voted this year?
Certainly the birthright citizenship case was a surprise, in that I think a lot of people on both sides of this issue think that even if you think there's a problem with nationwide injunctions, this was a rough case to test it on, because this is an order, that an executive order from the Trump administration, that clearly goes against what most people have thought is the understanding of the Constitution for the past 150 plus years. The fact that the majority chose that case to raise this issue, and thereby giving Donald Trump what seems to be a pretty significant win, was certainly noteworthy. And then just more generally, looking at the way the six Republican-appointed justices were pretty much all in alignment on the biggest cases as we headed to the end of the term was very striking.
What were your main takeaways from how Justice Amy Coney Barrett ruled this year? She, of course, authored the opinion that we've been mostly talking about in this conversation, but she's also been a justice that a lot of people have been really trying to scrutinize this year.
Yeah, there were certainly times earlier in the term where she aligned herself with the liberal justices, the three Democratic appointees, and there was a lot of talk of Amy Coney Barrett not so much being a moderate or not so much being a swing vote, but being somebody who's a little more restrained in what she wants to do than some of her conservative colleagues. But in all the, you know, other big cases, pretty much all the big ones that we might talk about are ones where she joined her fellow conservatives.
You know, people and institutions don't usually willingly hand over power, but I'm thinking about this ruling kind of really scaling back the federal court's ability, or at least lower court judges' ability, to issue nationwide injunctions, and last year's ruling giving big swaths of immunity to sitting executives. Do you see a connection between the two of them and what the six justices in the majority see as the proper balance between the federal courts and the executive branch?
Well, certainly it's a court that believes in a strong executive in a whole lot of ways. You know, this birthright citizenship decision does restrict the power of lower court judges. It doesn't restrict the Supreme Court's power, however. And in a concurring opinion, Justice Kavanaugh made that very clear, that what this means is that probably some of these issues are going to get to us more quickly, and we're going to be the ones who have to decide something. So it is a court that wants to restrain the judiciary in some respects, but ultimately it's reserving a pretty fair amount of power for itself.
That is Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr. Greg, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Republican senators are holding a rare Saturday session on Capitol Hill as they try to push President Trump's massive tax and spending bill through ahead of Trump's self-imposed deadline of July 4th. But there are several GOP senators who are opposed. A funeral was held today for former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, who were shot and killed in their home in what law enforcement says was a political shooting. Another state lawmaker and his wife were shot by the same gunman but survived. Former President Biden and former Vice President Harris attended, along with Governor Tim Walz. And hundreds of flights are canceled at the Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport today after severe storms hit the area last night with heavy rain, strong winds and hail. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The border region between San Diego and Tijuana is a busy binational area where people live life on the line. They go back and forth across the border constantly. People are connected across the U.S.-Mexico line in countless ways, economically, musically, culturally, more. The podcast Port of Entry from NPR member station KPBS tries to bring that fluidity to life. It also looks at how changing policies are affecting life on the border. We have the hosts of Port of Entry on the line with us today. Alan Lilienthal grew up in San Diego, and Natalie Gonzalez grew up in Tijuana. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Hey, great to be here.
This is a time where, obviously, the U.S. border with Mexico is under intense scrutiny, and immigration in general is something that's being talked about and debated, often by people thousands of miles away from you, supporters and opponents of the idea. Knowing what you do about living on the border, reporting out this podcast like you have, I'm curious what you think the biggest misconceptions are of the reality that you see every day.
A lot of what gets said about the border, whether in Congress or on cable news, I believe is completely disconnected from what life is actually like here, right? One of the biggest misconceptions is that the border is a place of chaos or danger, when in reality, it is a space of constant movement and connection and resilience. People here, we live full and complex lives, and we cross the border for school, for work, for family. And I don't think I'm trying to be completely positive here, but of course there are challenges. But this narrative of crisis all the time often ignores the humanity and the everyday of the border that me and my family and my friends and Alan have been living for decades.
Painting it as solely a place of conflict really misses the picture. Not to say a conflict doesn't occur here. I think anytime there's very diverse elements coming together, there's chemical reactions that are going to happen. So, of course, that exists, but it's so much more than that. That's just a one piece of the puzzle. There's so much vibrancy and interconnection here and cultural exchange that doesn't often get highlighted. So I think our hope and our aim with these stories we tell is to show the entire picture, not just in black and white, but with all the color that exists here.
Let's talk specifically a little bit more about Tijuana. You did an entire episode about it. It's called A Case for the Tijuana Dream. Tell us how people are thinking about living there a lot differently than maybe at least perceptions of decades before were.
We met this couple from Costa Rica and El Salvador. Javier and Rubí. Javier is from Costa Rica. Rubí is from El Salvador. Their daughter lived in Tijuana, and so they migrated from Costa Rica specifically to Tijuana to open up a business of food. So they were not trying to cross the border to go up north to the States to make a living. They knew and they were sure that they were going to be fine and that they were going to be able to settle down in Tijuana because of the richness of this border region.
We're not making a ton of money, but we have work and we are getting by little by little.
There's a shifting tide in perception, people from all over the world come to Tijuana with a dream of getting into the U.S., but there is a change happening with people realizing that the dream can be lived in Tijuana with a lot less red tape and a lot more affordability, because so many people not only live in Tijuana and work in America and bring the dollars back home, but a lot of Americans go to Tijuana. So there's so much opportunity in Tijuana that you don't have to cross the border for. And a lot of people are realizing that and staying in Tijuana.
That is Alan Lilienthal and Natalie Gonzalez of the KPBS podcast, Port of Entry. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much to both of you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, Scott.
Often when we see a movie, we talk about whether the ending worked or didn't work. For this week's movie segment, my colleague Andrew Limbong spoke with two NPR producers about how important the setup is of a movie storyline.
Every story has a premise, an idea that sets it into motion. Some narratives, particularly films, have premises that stick with us more than others. For whatever reason, they grab us in a way that we can't forget or shake. There are those that envision new realities.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us.
That hurl their characters in motion, or stories that throw a sci-fi twist into the mix of an otherwise recognizable breakup story.
Please let me keep this memory. Just this one.
Like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, or a new take on classics that turn old premises on their heads, like Wicked.
The best way to bring folks together is to give them a real good enemy.
So today, we want to talk about films that get off to the right start better than others, even when they don't always stick the landing. I'm joined by two NPR producers, Weekend Editions' Ryan Benk and All Things Considered's Manuela Lopez Restrepo. Thanks for being here, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Ryan, I want to start with you. When you're looking for a premise, right, and you're looking for one that breaks the mold, what are you looking for?
All right, so like, I mean, it's a really basic thing, but it has to be interesting.
Sure.
And you know, like, but that doesn't mean that it always has to be something completely new. Like, I mean, you know, depending on who you talk to, there might be as few as like 8 really novel stories out there. But it doesn't matter about the general story beats if you're talking premise. It's about how they're presented. So, for example, there's this little sci-fi indie from 2009 called Pandorum.
Where's the rest of the crew?
I don't really know, sir.
It's Lieutenant Payton. Anyone respond?
The plot? Total ripoff. I mean, people in space trying to find a new home after killing Earth. They wake up in a spaceship to find, oh, they're not alone.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but if you look at that premise, which is like an alien clone, they also added this dash of memento, which is that these characters have lost their memory. They've been in cryosleep for so long, they have no idea what their mission is. They barely know who they are or where they're supposed to be going. So as they're being hunted by these aliens, they're also having to relearn who they are and why the heck they're in this situation in the first place. So it's not exactly an Oscar-worthy film, but a premise I haven't forgotten since I watched the movie in college.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that if you ascribe to that William Faulkner idea that there are only like a handful of stories, right? Mm-hmm. For you, it's all about how they're like mixed and matched together and like stacked on top of each other like Jenga blocks.
Right, exactly. The idea is that you just have to make it interesting. You have to make it seem new, even if it isn't.
Yeah. Manuela, what about you? What are you looking for in a good premise?
I think something that I just generally expand with all art is just a feeling of effortlessness with the world building. Huh. How are we being immersed in the story? How are we being presented with the logic of this world? And how willing are we to suspend our judgment when we're allowing ourselves to kind of get taken away by it? So I know you mentioned Eternal Sunshine in the intro.
For people who haven't seen it, what is the premise of this movie?
So it's basically this romantic drama that plays around with the concept of a world where you have the option to erase the memory of your ex. And it follows this couple that is sort of presented with this opportunity.
By the time you wake up in the morning, all the memories were targeted with withered and disappeared, as in a dream upon waking.
Is there any risk of brain damage?
Well, I feel like I have to reference it as one of the most solid examples of this that I can think of. And it's not just because I rewatch it every time I get dumped by somebody, but...
Brutal, dude. Why would you? That's a horrible thing. That's a horrible decision.
I love pain, but... also just think it's because, like, you're not given that much time to sort of catch up with what's happening. And I think we're just sort of dropped into Joel's bleak world. And you might not agree with the way he's making decisions, but I think it becomes really easy to get kind of wrapped up into why he's making his choices. But I think that movies that suck me in the quickest are the ones that are just making these choices that are really bold and they're not really apologetic about it at all.
Ryan, are there any movies whose premise where it's like, you hear it and you're like, oh, don't even tell me anymore. Ticket sold. I'm in.
Oh, God. The Lobster. It's this Yorgos Lanthimos movie from 2016. Basically, the premise is if you don't find a romantic partner fast enough, you get sent to this unsettling but posh retreat where you have a certain amount of time to find one before you're turned into an animal.
Now, the fact that you'll turn into an animal if you fail to fall in love with someone during your stay here is not something that should upset you or get you down. Just think, as an animal, you'll have a second chance to find a companion.
Now, I was happily partnered at the time, and I am still happily partnered.
Sure, yeah.
But watching it and thinking about it now, I can't help but imagine a world where if I wasn't, you know, I'd really, really get that feeling that I was running out of time. So that's yeah. Something that's always stuck with me.
Yeah, Manuela, is there one for you that's like, I'm seated. I've heard enough. I've heard the 2-sentence log line, ticket purchase.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was one that like didn't quite hit for me until I saw it. But a couple of months ago, I watched Jonathan Glazer's 2004 psych thriller Birth. It's both simple and not simple, but this woman, Anna, lives in New York City. It's been 10 years since her beloved Sean has died. And she's finally moving on with her life. And she has an engagement party with her new beau. And a little boy named Sean shows up and claims that he is her deceased husband.
I understand that this is gonna sound crazy. I've met somebody who seems to be Sean.
You know, at first everybody thinks it's kind of this like charming, funny, strange prank that this kid is trying to pull. But as the plot sort of reveals itself and as we get to know little Sean better, he begins to reveal information that really only her dead husband could have known.
What if Bob comes to my house and tests me?
How do you know Bob?
He was my brother-in-law.
And so you watch Anna begin to question herself and her sanity, and I feel like it's set up so powerfully, and it's kind of one of those movies where you begin to question yourself alongside Anna. And ultimately, it's just like a super poignant meditation on how transformative grief can be, for better or in this case, for worse.
All right, now let's talk about some movies that peter out. Ryan, anything that you're like, oh, I was hyped for it, and then you got to the end, it's like, oof, whiffed it.
Yeah, I mean, so I wouldn't call this a whiff, but it doesn't really stick the landing. But David Cronenberg's most recent film, The Shrouds, like we interviewed him on Weekend Edition about it. It's so deeply personal, and it's about his own grief. It starts with this premise that just is so dark, but like so interesting to me. It's this grieving man who looks suspiciously like David Cronenberg, who creates this technology that allows people to watch their loved ones as they decompose in their grave.
When they lowered my wife into the coffin, I had an intense urge to get into the box with her.
You never considered cremation?
How dark are you willing to go?
Like I said, it's dark, it's lonely, it's brooding, and there's this mystery that just tugs on the story and moves much of the film forward. But the reveal at the end, I wouldn't call it a letdown per se, but it's just kind of confusing. Still, with the premise and this solid performance by Vincent Cassel, I would say it's so good that I would urge anyone to give it a try.
Manuela, anything didn't work for you?
So I'm not original in saying this, but I usually go into just about any biopic with the expectation that I'm going to be disappointed. And
okay.
Love
That's a good
King
attitude
Chalamet.
To
It's called being realistic.
Yeah.
And like love Timisi as I might. Last year's A Complete Unknown still managed to shock me with how off I felt just about every aspect of the execution was.
200 people in that room, each one wants me to be somebody else. They should just let me be.
Let you be what?
Whatever it is they don't want me to be.
I just feel like a life as large as Bob Dylan sounds so exciting. There's so much there story-wise. And I think reality is ultimately one of the most difficult premises to pull off when you're sort of recreating it, because we all have pretty abundant material to compare and contrast with. So I was bored with the tale of the Bard, which I think is crazy. And in this case, like almost every other case with a biopic, you're probably better off watching Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story.
That is your North Star for biopics, yeah.
Absolutely. Every biopic thus far has been felled by the sword of Walk Hard.
Nice. That was NPR's Ryan Benk and Manuela Lopez Restrepo. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's summer, which means it is swimming season. The pool, the lake, the ocean. With that in mind, we have some tips on how to stay safe in the water and keep an eye on people swimming, because drowning is the number one cause of death for kids age 1 to 4. It happens fast and quietly, and sometimes it can even look like play. Mariel Segarra, host of NPR's podcast Life Kit, tells us what to watch for.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it can take as little as 20 seconds for a child to drown. And a lot of the time, when a kid drowns, there are adults present. That was the case when Shazik Sonoda's 3-year-old son drowned in a backyard pool in 2018. His name was Yori.
Once that happened, obviously it turned my life upside down. And I recognized how many people and parents didn't have all of the understanding and tools to keep their children safe.
After Yori's death, Sonoda started a nonprofit called No More Under. It's focused on water safety. Here are some of their tips. If you have a pool in your backyard, make sure it has a four-sided fence around it and a cover you can put over it. If you have a hot tub, cover that up too. Or a kiddie pool, empty that out after every use.
You're not just even concerned about your children, you're concerned about other children in the neighborhood that might walk in, and it's about keeping the whole community safe.
When you're done in the pool, remove all the toys and pool noodles, anything that might entice a child to jump in. You can also put an alarm on your back door that'll ring when one of your kids goes outside. Now, if you're going to be near open water, like a lake or the ocean, put your kid in a U.S. Coast Guard approved life jacket. It'll say that on a label in the back. For kids who aren't strong swimmers, consider a life jacket at the pool too. And fit is important here. Make sure the life jacket doesn't rise up past their ears.
Because if it goes above your ears, well, then it's going above your mouth and your nose, and you're still going to go underwater.
Avoid putting kids in water wings or swimmies, you know, the ones that go on their arms. They are cute, but they can slip off, and they might give you or your kids a false sense of security. Also, this is important, designate a water watcher, an adult who knows it's their job to watch the water and the kids in it.
Often these tragedies happen because someone thinks someone else is watching. And again, this quick, quiet moment happens and you still hear playing, but all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, there's a voice missing.
If there are several adults present, switch places every 15 or 20 minutes so no one loses focus. You can download a free water watcher badge from the No More Under website. Those make it clear who's on duty. And Sonoda says from the time your kids are old enough to understand, you should be talking to them about how to stay safe around water. The same way you'd talk about wearing a seatbelt or crossing the street.
Hey, you never swim alone. You always ask for permission before you get into the water and look for lifeguards. And again, most importantly, make sure that someone is watching you.
Also, put your kids in swim lessons. The American Association of Pediatrics recommends those for kids as young as 1 year old. We talked to an expert with the National Drowning Prevention Alliance about what to do if you do see someone struggling or drowning in a pool and there's no lifeguard around. She said to call 911 as soon as possible, and if you can avoid it, don't jump into the water with them. Instead, reach out a pole or another object and pull them to safety from the land. If you do have to jump in, bring a flotation device and keep it between you. For NPR News, I'm Mariel Segarra.
This is NPR News.
As a teen, he played the accordion at Louisiana house parties. Later, he'd inspire musicians from Mick Jagger to Lucinda Williams.
When you hear something like Clifton Chenier, something that's powerful and deep and soulful, you can tell this music is coming from a real person and a real place in their heart.
Honoring the King of Zydeco, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney says his government will continue to engage in trade talks with the U.S. and work for the best interests of Canadians. His comments follow President Trump's announcement yesterday that he's ending trade talks with Canada over Ottawa's digital services tax on American tech companies. In Hungary, tens of thousands defied a government ban and police orders to march today in what organizers are calling the biggest LGBTQ pride event in the country's history. It's an open rebuke to the Prime Minister Orbán's office, which says pride events are a violation of children's rights to moral and spiritual development. And Chrysler's parent company Stellantis is recalling some of its 2022 to 2025 Pacifica and Voyager vehicles to inspect and replace side airbags if needed. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Yesterday, in a Manhattan federal courtroom, the defense gave its closing argument in the criminal trial against Sean Combs. The hip-hop mogul, known through the years as Diddy or Puff Daddy, is facing federal charges of sex trafficking and racketeering. NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Tsiolkas was at court yesterday and joins us for an update. And just a note, this conversation will include descriptions of physical and sexual violence. Anastasia, hey.
Hi there.
The trial began in early May. It has been, to put it mildly, a lot to follow. Can you give us a brief overview of what the charges are, what the scope of this has been?
Sure thing, Scott. Well, federal prosecutors have charged Sean Combs, who has been a major force in hip-hop since the 1990s, of forcing two ex-girlfriends into sex and drug marathons that involved encounters with male sex workers at locations across the country. And they're also accusing him of using his legitimate business empire, which spans fashion and music and liquor and television, to hide those alleged criminal activities over some 20 years. And Combs has pleaded not guilty to all the charges.
How exactly did the prosecution lay out their case?
They presented witnesses and evidence for 6 weeks, Scott, which included having more than 30 people testifying. And those folks included the two girlfriends, the singer and model Cassandra Cassie Ventura, and another more recent girlfriend who testified under the pseudonym Jane. And the jury also heard from dozens of corroborating witnesses. They saw video clips of those alleged marathon sessions, which Combs referred to as freak-offs, hotel nights, or Wild King nights. And they've also seen video of Combs beating Ventura as she tried to escape one of those sessions. They've also seen literal receipts of the travel and hotel expenses for the male escorts that Combs' company paid for.
These are a lot of allegations. How did Combs' defense try to counter them?
They've said from the beginning, Scott, that all of those sexual encounters were consensual. And for most of the trial, they said they would have witnesses on the stand themselves for at least a couple of days. But instead, they called no witnesses at all, and they presented their defense case in just half an hour.
Just a half hour? I mean, compared to 6 weeks, that is remarkably short.
It really is. So their main tactic during both cross-examinations and then again in closing arguments yesterday was mostly to undermine the witnesses' credibility as best they could. Defense lawyer Mark Agnifilo sought to reframe the prosecution's narratives that they'd built over those 6 weeks. He said, quote, Cassie is nobody's fool. She's sitting somewhere in the world today with $30 million. He's in jail. It's like a slaughter. Agnifilo here was referring to civil settlements Ventura received from Combs and also from the owner of the hotel where Combs was taped physically beating her in 2016. And Agnifilo also said, yes, the relationship was full of domestic violence, but he also called it, quote, a great modern love story.
So this goes to the jury now?
Yes. Jury deliberations are set to begin on Monday, and if Combs is found guilty of all the charges, which are sex trafficking, transportation to engage in prostitution, and racketeering, he could face up to the rest of his life in prison.
That is NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkos. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sally Ride was the first American woman to go to space back in 1983, and for a while it seemed like she was the most famous person on Earth and in space. She dominated headlines, she was all over TV, kids got to meet her when she made an appearance on Sesame Street.
Hey, do you all know who this person is here?
Yeah.
You do? What's her name?
Sally Ride!
Yeah.
But Sally Ride was also a very private person, and all that time, everyone was totally in the dark about a very important aspect of her life. It was not until Ride died in 2012 that the world learned about her 27-year-long relationship with her partner, Tam O'Shaughnessy. A new documentary from National Geographic gives us new insight into Ride's life. Christina Costantini, the director of Sally, is here with us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
What drew you to Sally Ride's story, and why did you feel like now was the time to tell it?
Yeah, you know, I like many girls, was a big fan of Sally as a kid, and I think it was a very simple equation. It was just, you know, if Sally, a girl, can go to space and do big things, maybe I can do big things too. And I think for so many of us young women and girls, that was the motivating factor. And then when I learned about Tam O'Shaughnessy, her life partner, when she passed away, I thought, oh my gosh, this story is way more interesting. You know, NASA was barely ready for women. They would not have been ready for this. And so this film is really for anyone who's ever had to hide part of themselves to get where they want to be. And I think in 2025, that's a more relevant and more important story than ever.
Yeah, I had such mixed feelings watching this because a large part of the movie is the clips of her talking and the way that I remember watching as a kid, just the way that she's so calm and so cool and so like, oh yeah, no big deal, flying in a space shuttle, you know, and just the way that she was like this hyper competent, inspiring person. And then at the same time, you're really getting to the fact that in a way so much of that was a facade, and she had this really painful secret that she felt like she could not share with the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot to get into, but let's just start with the fact that her partner, Tam, is such a big part of this movie. Was it hard to get her to participate, or was that something that she was ready and open to do?
You know, to Tam's great credit, this is a story that she wanted to tell. I think it was important for her that the world know the real Sally. Every astronaut from the beginning of time, you know, our very early Mercury astronauts, they stood next to their wives, or Apollo astronauts stood next to their wives, and their wives were celebrated along with them. And Tam never had that. And so in some ways, this film is correcting a history that was never told while Sally was alive. But Tam is an incredible person, and we've grown very, very close in making this film. And I think Sally's quite hard to understand, quite hard to read, and she becomes kind of the interpreter for us, for Sally.
Yeah.
And tells a very complicated story of who this person is.
Christina, I'm curious about your experience making this movie, because you're sifting through at the same time all of these interviews and public appearances where Sally Ride has this carefully crafted demeanor.
Yeah.
And then you're talking to people like Tam and others in her life who knew the full story. What do you think was lost to the world by the fact that this important part of her wasn't known in real time?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a real tragedy that Sally couldn't be Sally publicly while she was alive, or didn't feel like she could be. But Sally also was an introvert. She didn't like the public eye. And so I think you get to meet the real Sally a bit in this documentary. She's really funny. She's quick. Some of my favorite scenes are the scenes of her in press conferences when people are asking her if she would weep or if she's going to be serving coffee to men. I think she did an incredible job of walking this very fine line.
You're mentioning this whole other plot point and this big story for not just Sally, but the other women in her astronaut class. You're talking about this one particular press conference.
When there was a problem, when there was a glitch or whatever, how did you respond? Do you weep? Do you, what do you do?
Why doesn't anybody ask Rick those questions?
It's the commander weeps.
I don't think that I react any differently than
I mean, it's just so farcical to hear that. And my two thoughts were, one, the way that she just kind of smirks and she's clearly bothered, but she lets it roll off her back, at least publicly.
Yeah.
And two, I'm just thinking, I'm like, this is like the early mid-80s. Like, this wasn't actually that long ago. And yet this idea of a woman doing this was just like unheard of to these reporters. Like, what was your takeaway from that dynamic?
You know, it really gave me hope that change can happen, and change happens. You know, change has happened. I mean, they are some of the most offensive questions I've heard. The late night shows were obsessed with her. You know, is she going to bring a handbag up to space? Is it going to match her shoes? And like, NASA gave her a makeup kit and packed her 100 tampons for a 6-day journey. So there is a lot of humor in just how strange this was to especially the male world for a woman to be in space.
Can I just follow up? Because I had heard that anecdote of like the tampons as some sort of meeting, like, well, how many do you think you would need? But in the movie, you point out they actually gave her a pack of like, here's 100
tampons. I mean, I love that story so much. They were trying to calculate. And I think it perfectly embodies, you know, the NASA engineers, the smartest people in the world. They can't figure out the very basics of like the female menstrual cycle. and that's what NASA was at the time. When they arrived, there were no other women, and they were doing everything they could to fit into this male dominated environment. They were dressing like the men. They were talking like the men. Every time people would ask them what it was like to be a female astronaut, they would say, I'm an astronaut. They would do everything they could to blend in. But then there were these moments like it becomes so absurd.
Well, that makes me wonder, you have now spent 2 years learning all the complexities of her. And I'm wondering, mm-hmm. at the end of this project, is there one anecdote or is there one moment that really to you says, like, this is Sally Ride?
That's a great question. There's so many great stories. I really feel like at the end of the day, this is a love story. And I think Sally was very private and very buttoned up her whole life. And in her final weeks of life, she made the decision that Tam should tell this story, that Tam should be out in the open, and basically called her into her room and said, you tell who you need to tell. You know, we should be who you think we should be to the public. And, I think that was Sally correcting many years of forcing Tam to live in the closet with her. And a very, very brave act. And, you know, they eventually exchanged rings, they became domestic partners and legally. And I think that was very meaningful for Tam. And it's great to be able to celebrate that Sally, at the end of her life, came to that realization that they needed to be who they were in public and in private.
That is Christina Costantini, director of the documentary Sally, about astronaut Sally Ride. It is streaming. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Imagine if your favorite artist suddenly dropped not one, not two, not three, but 7 new albums all at once. That is what Bruce Springsteen did this week when he let loose Tracks 2, The Lost Albums, a box set of never-before-released music that he recorded over the course of nearly 3 decades. I hate the war, right out my memory. The collection explores many of the boss's different eras, with music spanning from 1983 to 2018. And here to talk with us about a few standout moments from these lost albums is music journalist Karen Rose. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is not the first time that Springsteen has put out unreleased material from his vault, but this was pretty different from the last time, right?
This is astronomically different. It's records. It's not just here's a loosely chronologically organized selection of songs that never got released or got recorded but didn't make the records. Most people have not heard this stuff before.
When I heard that this was coming, I was a little skeptical because often when somebody puts out, this was never released before, you hear it and you think, perhaps there was a reason why or it's not quite finished. But these are all distinct albums from distinct eras.
I had always heard that he had done some kind of gospel record, mm-hmm. and I didn't realize it was mostly an instrumental for, and it was meant as a track to a movie that had never gotten made. But this was the first time where it's like, okay, yes, it exists. This is the forms that it exists in. Here it is, finished. You can listen to it now.
Tell us about some of the other surprises, because you mentioned there's that, and there's also a country album.
The country record is the one that has the broadest appeal. There's a highway over yonder. This was their stress relief from recording The Ghost of Tom Joad during the day.
And that would have been what, the early, mid-90s? That was his solo folk album?
Yes, that was his solo folk album in 1995. He was working on this in 95. And with the same musicians, they would just let loose. We would
never know. I keep gravitating toward that country record as well. What's another one that surprised you or you just enjoyed listening to?
I'm going to have to give you two here because it's really hard for me to choose. There's Inyo, which is a record that is, again, more folky, more acoustic, but it's really got its roots in the Southwest, in Southern California. There's two mariachi bands on there. It's really just kind of amazing the way that he immersed himself in the culture, in the stories, and in the music. And then there's Twilight Hours, which is like Bruce is a crooner. It's really all about his vocals, which for a guy that really likes to hide behind his guitar when he talks is kind of amazing to consider. As the darkness gives way to the light
of another long and lonely day. This is an artist who has been performing long enough that I started listening to as a teenager. And now I'm old enough to actually be in the middle-aged male cartoonish demographic that he was always kind of talked about at, you know, and he's still going. So there's a big sample size to begin with for Bruce Springsteen of many, many years of content. What do you think this adds to your appreciation of his range or his influence or his style?
What's really interesting about Bruce is that he has always been a really diligent editor of his own work, probably to his detriment. None of these records would have hurt his legacy. The existence of them now, I think all it really does is expand on that and just show how much he was always working, even when it may have seemed from the outside he wasn't. I, as a fan, never really thought, oh, where's Bruce Springsteen? Where's the next record? Because we trusted that he was going to give us something when he was ready to give it to us.
That is music journalist Karen Rose. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's All Things Considered for this Saturday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station. Hey.
wee hours with Eric Clapton. Man of the Blues. That's when I think of you. In the wee wee hours, that's when I think of you.